podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It's a wonderful honor for me tonight to welcome to New Mexico a great journalist and a great person, Maria Hinojosa. She is the award-winning anchor of Latino USA and the TV program Maria Hinojosa One-on-One. She's worked at CNN and at CBS News and at NBC Television. She's a contributing correspondent for Need to Know on PBS, and she was a senior correspondent for Now on PBS. She is the author of two books, and she's now writing a weekly syndicated column for King Features, which check that out. Look out for it. She's working on a Frontline documentary, and she's started the Futuro Media Group. She's won two Emmy Awards and numerous awards for outstanding journalism. Maria's just boundless curiosity for life and passion for life bring us the really important and interesting stories, I think, that we need to hear. Her work is not only reporting, but defining what stories should be reported. And so in her programs, we get everything from United States and Latin American politics to music and literature, the issues of women and girls around the world, the realities of gangs. We get cooking, movies, really pretty much everything under the sun. And if you haven't seen One-on-One, you should really see it. You can find it on iTunes. It's just a wonderful interview program on television that you can get on the internet. Maria Hinojosa, I think, is what I wish every journalist were: morally engaged, broadly intelligent, discerning, internationally focused, and above all, a truth teller. Born in Mexico, raised in Chicago, deeply rooted in both countries, Maria Hinojosa's work is an example of the power and intelligence and richness that can come from living in multiple cultures, multiple countries, multiple languages. It would be nice if everyone in the United States could see and perceive and understand this richness. Right now, we're trying, I think somewhat unsuccessfully so far, to deal with immigration, which is usually framed in the media as a problem, rather than as the fundamental reality of this continent for the last four centuries. And as long as there have been immigrants, somebody's been giving them a hard time. I'm going to give you a few random examples. In 1753, before this was even a country, Benjamin Franklin wrote that German immigrants were ignorant, stupid, unable to make use of liberty, and they were a threat to the English language. And he lamented that there were just so few white people in this world, he wished there were more. Our country has a rather unpleasant history of lynching immigrants, Irish, Italian, Mexican, Chinese, as well as African American people. In the 1850s, there was a political party called the Know Nothing Party. Yes, they called themselves that. They ran candidates on an anti-immigrant platform. They won elections in several states. More than half of the states in the United States prohibited the use of the German language during World War I, and after that, German language teaching was banned in a lot of public high schools. The legislative attacks on immigrants continue through the present day, even in the state of New Mexico, which was once Mexico, where our Mexican-American governor wants to deny driver's licenses to Mexicans. And of course, all the while, immigrants have worked incredibly hard, and as a friend of mine said, the Protestant work ethic really should be called the immigrant work ethic. And they have both assimilated into U.S. mainstream society, and they've built institutions that have kept their original cultures and languages alive. Biculturalism, multiculturalism are nothing new. It's been going on for centuries. It's worth reminding ourselves, I think, that the way we live and so many of the things that we love and do and consider American and just consider part of our lives, okay, Christmas trees, Frankfurters, beer, cappuccino, acupuncture, tango and salsa, and many of the words in the English language, our sense of humor, our innovation, our ingenuity, all come really in large part from immigrant groups and people who were once looked down upon by the so-called mainstream, which was really just the previous immigrant group. So the contributions of the many, many Latin cultures in the U.S., I think, are little by little being felt and absorbed here. And it's through cultural bridge builders like Maria Hinojosa that we can get to know ourselves as Americans, Americanos, in the larger sense, seeing our ties to the entire continent in the Western Hemisphere, and really being enriched and changed for the better by that understanding. So I would like now to let you welcome, and I'm going to use the words from her own book, Raising Raul, Latina Gringa, a crazy mixture of Azteca New Yorker, salsa-dancing, goddess-worshipping, hard-hitting journalist, Ivy League-educated, Chicago-raised, barrio-living, and I would like to add honorary New Mexican, Bienvenida María Hinojosa.
Wow. Gosh, you guys, and I haven't even said a word. I want to take you with me all the time. Can I just put you in my back pocket? So when I start to feel down and lonely, happens a lot when you're doing this kind of work. So actually, this image will stay with me because I need it. It's actually not so funny, but I get why you want to laugh, because it's like, let's break the ice, but it's really an intense time out there, which is why I really want to thank Patrick Lannan and the Lannan Foundation for having me here today in this place with all of you. Patrick, thank you so much. It really means the world to me to be able to be here, because it means that I feel like I have a community. And community is really, really super important. The fact is that I spend a lot of my time getting from one place to another. So my community becomes my crew, whoever I'm working with at that particular time, and it's my family. But when I'm out and about, I don't have you with me in the back of my pocket, although I kind of like that image, so I think I'm going to keep it with me. But, you know, the essence of community is so important because it changes everything when you have human contact. It changes our minds. We no longer feel like this person is less than human because at this point you have made a contact with them. And community does just that. It allows you to feel bonded to a fellow human being. The enemy becomes less your enemy once you have touched this person. And this person has felt your touch. And that's why, really, I touch everyone who I interview. Except for when I'm not allowed. And it has happened. It's been a little weird, but I've completely pulled back. But I have to respect that there are traditions where that is not allowed. But I do touch, because I do think that there's something that happens in that moment. And you're probably wondering now, why is she talking about humanity and touching people? I thought she was going to talk about immigration and the border. What is she talking about? Because actually, my friends, mis queridos amigos, I am in a state of shock. But I can only tell you a little bit about what I have seen, because I am in the midst of it. And so there's only so much that I can reveal. There are stories that I will tell you about, stuff that is coming up, like right now, this week, on Latino USA. We'll have a very big, special half-hour documentary about the Dominican Republic, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. We have a piece coming up on Need to Know, also about the Dominican Republic, and actually the same issue that I'll be talking about here, which is deportations and detentions of the other. In this case, Dominicans deporting Haitians. Yeah, it's very ugly. But I am actually deep, deep in a frontline documentary. As far as I know, I'm the first Latina to anchor a frontline documentary, so I am really... It took a long time. But I was not going to give up. I was just not going to give up. And thankfully, I'm there. And I'm working with, you know, the most serious, top-notch investigative crew in the country. And in, you know, parts of the world. So I'm really honored. It is a documentary about immigrant detention centers and policies leading up to that. So that's a little bit about where I've been. I'm going to get to that in a second. But, you know, like you, every day I wake up and I check the headlines, whether it's, you know, on the web or real paper or Twitter or Facebook. I know. I could never imagine that I would be saying I check headlines on Twitter. Oh, my God. What has happened to me? But, you know, I check these headlines and I'm just like, what is happening in this world? What is happening in our world? How is this possible? And while I know that there's a way of looking at what's happening in our world as this extraordinary bubbling up of democracy and of voice and of wanting voice, I think what I'm more freaked out about is the reactions to that. And it's specifically in our country, you know, what our president has done. So, you know, I just can't kind of, well, actually, wait, that comes up later. I was almost going to tell you, but it's in later in my speech, so hold on. The thing is that I actually do often see my reality as half empty. I wish I was that kind of like, no, it's half full, really, it's half full. But these days, the reality is that I do tend to see it half empty. And there is a separate conversation to be had about women and about Latinas and about depression. Latina teenagers have the highest rate of attempted suicide in our country. Latina teens have the highest rate of attempted suicide in our country. They do not complete, but they have the highest rate of attempted, which is, of course, a yearning to be heard. Thankfully, I am not clinically depressed. My cure is that I work out, I run, I have music with me wherever, and now today I bought my candle. Oh, and I have my fetish. Yes! I have my fetish. It's in my bag. I'm so happy. Thank you, Laureen, wherever you are. I'm so happy. I, like, put it on my Facebook and tweeted, I have fetishes for my whole family. And they're just like, what? I'm like, zoomy. It's really, really cool. But I'm not depressed. I work out, like I said, and I do kickboxing, and I lift weights. So that keeps me settled, and I communicate with nature, and I have an amazing husband and kids. But there is absolutely reason to be depressed. You know, just reading the paper yesterday, there's a story that I can't get out of my mind. It was a little tiny blip in the paper, in the Times, actually, the hard copy, because I was reading it in the paper, in the plane, you know, that 16-hour plane right from New York to here. I want a direct flight, please, New York, Albuquerque, please. So, you know, it was a story about a massacre in a village in the Ivory Coast. And they were saying, you know, well, maybe 150 people, but human rights workers were saying more like 300. And they just walked in and there were bodies everywhere, and bodies of children and bodies of women and bodies of men. And I just, them thinking about the terror that they must have felt. And then I think about Rwanda, where I was, and Nairobi, where I was, also with these images of horror. And I was thinking about, what is it about human beings that we can do this to one another? And it comes back to where I started, which I'm really glad, I'm sure you're really glad that I found my way to get back to where I started, which was about humanity, community, touching, seeing someone, seeing yourself and the person most unlike you, being able to really identify with that person who couldn't be more different than you. And the fact is that when you don't have that, then you dehumanize. You dehumanize. And once you dehumanize, then that's it, basically. Anything can happen. Anywhere. Because these people, this group, is less than human. Is so different than me that There's nothing I share with them at all. So that leads me to a scenario that I'm going to paint for you. And I am going to ask you to tell me where you think, what country you think I'm describing. All right, you are detained. While you are detained, you are fed food that has maggots in it. There is a complaint box, but it is locked. You have to use the toilets in public. There are no partitions. There are five toilets just right next to each other. There's a wall there, and then there are five shower heads. So no partitions, and you basically have to use the toilet and shower with strangers in public. You do not have access to a lawyer or a judge by law. In other words, you are not guaranteed that by law. you can be held with no option to plead your case. You are held mandatorily by law. Mandatorily detained. You are not allowed to post bail or bond at all. You are not promised a phone call. You might get it or you might not, but it's not promised to you. You might be sexually assaulted by a guard while you are in a room sleeping with 50 strangers. And you will be told that sleeping with 50 strangers like this in a public space with bunks is actually good for your socialization. You don't have windows. The windows that do exist actually are cordoned off, and you cannot get close to them. The closest you can get is about 3 feet. You can go for days without seeing sunlight. There is no way for you to demand having sunlight. It will really just depend up to the guards. You might even be sent to a foreign country by mistake. And it would be the mistake of the government of this country that I'm describing for you. And they would have to go and get you and bring you back because they sent you someplace by mistake. You are not, in fact, a felon. You are not, in fact, a criminal. But you do wear a uniform that says jail or prisoner on it. When you arrive, men and women, you will get used sheets. You will, if you're a woman, get underwear that is bloodstained. When you're on a period and you're a woman, you will not get more than one pad at a time. You will have to ask for one every time you need one. Sometimes, if you don't have a pad, well, there's no toilet paper either. There's nothing that you can really do but wait. Wait for a guard to get you some. Hence, the stained underwear. You do not have access to filtered water. The cups, in fact, are behind a locked door. And the water that you do have that comes out of the faucet tastes like chlorine and makes you sick, so you don't drink it. So, where am I? Yeah, it's the United States of America. Right here, right now, today, at this very moment. I want you all to just sit and think. I'm going to just give you another one of these, okay? Because I know I gave you a long list. But I need you to know, I need you to hear about something that is happening in our country, in our midst. What would happen if you were fed food with maggots? Uncooked chicken. And why? Because actually, if you serve food that's spoiled, it ends up being cheaper in the end. What would it be like to have to ask for a pad and maybe get one? what would it be like to want to complain? But there's no place to complain to. And actually, when you do complain, you worry about retribution. What does that retribution look like? Well, you know when I told you about that, you're sent to a foreign country by mistake? That's a little bit about what retribution can look like. So, how did this happen? How many of you knew, honestly, that all of those things that I mentioned, how many of you, raise your hand, if you knew that all of those things, every single one of them that I told you existed? A lot more than I expected then. Okay? I expected none of you to raise your hands. Because this is not a story that is told most often. It's not told because it's toxic. It's a toxic story to tell. It's a toxic issue. I don't quite know why, but toxic is the word that has come to me when I just think about why it is that we can't talk about this. We're not making stuff up here. There's no political agenda. I'm a fact-based journalist. That's what I do. So, how did this happen? Well, on a technical level, it's because of two things. I bet that many of you, although you are clearly a very smart audience, 1996 immigration reform. Not 1986, which everybody knows, Immigration Reform and Control Act, IRCA, that big moment of amnesty, so-called amnesty. No, 1996, Bill Clinton in power. And the Republicans had taken the House and Senate. And that was when there was not a lot of worry about undocumented immigrants. Actually, immigration was not even kind of on the front burner. Well, this is when these reforms happened that basically decided to put teeth into immigration. The sense was that, you know, immigration laws had been lax, and there really needed to be a system of going and detaining people and searching them down and getting tough with the law. Something else happened, September 11th, which basically pushed a lot of these detention centers to be built pretty quickly because there was a sense that something had to happen. The laws were on the books, and now we just needed the spaces. Which brings me to a third thing that is not quite tied into it, but there were certainly people who understood what was happening here, which is the whole advent of private prisons. Immigrant detainees are the fastest growing use of private prisons in our country. So when you have a bed filled with a body, it equates into a profit for someone. Okay? So just picture that for a second when we think about capitalism, where everybody wants to increase their profits. That's what it's about. Geez, you know, even good old liberals and socialists that I know even want to increase their profits. So here we are talking about increasing your profits, and the way you do that is by increasing the number of people who you have in a bed. So it's beds and profits. Because you have investors and they want to get paid. Now we have to recognize we have the largest civil detention system in the world now exists in the United States. Right now, in the world. Now, Lorraine, of course, Lorraine Mills, gave me all kinds of information about Santa Fe. Like I said, I have my fetish. But now I also learned that right here we had internment camps right here in Santa Fe. So I think we have to have a conversation in our country about criminal corrections versus civil detention. There's a very big difference. There's a big difference. It's not the same thing. Who is being detained? Who exactly is being detained? We are told by the Obama administration that they are detaining the most serious criminals. Now everybody uses these terms, criminal aliens. You know, it was illegal aliens, it's criminal aliens. Now the term goes hand in hand. And that, when you do that kind of stuff and use that kind of language leads to what I started off with, which is dehumanization. They're just the other. I mean, really, who cares how they're treated? They're different than us. They're not like us. They're others. They're illegal. Now, there was a moment a couple of years back when I actually did sit down and have an interview with your friend, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, from the state over. And now, I have to say that I have done a lot of interviews in my life. I have interviewed, you know, skinheads and Aryan racists and, you know, CEOs and tough lawyers and people in, yeah, I know you just, I kind of threw that in there. You know, I have interviewed, but I have never really, I was bullied for a moment when I was covering the Elian situation down in Miami. And at that time I worked for CNN and that was known as a Cuban news network because Ted Turner liked Fidel. And so I was almost assaulted then by several elderly folks who were Cuban, who were not happy to see me there. But apart from that, I really have not been bullied. In almost every situation, interviewing gang members, everything, I really have not been bullied except for Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was really having a grand time bullying me. And I was kind of holding it all together because I was representing you. And I had you in my back pocket even then. Thank you. So I held it together. I was sweating tons. I was like, oh my God, it's going to look all watery, you know, because it is a visual medium. And, you know, and then at one point, Joe Arpaio, sorry, says, now, I use the term that they use. I would have used illegal alien just because I do that with people. I use their term mostly when I'm having a conversation. Well, today, for some reason, maybe because he was bullying me, I was just using the term undocumented immigrant. And so at one point in the interview, he just turns around and says, I got to ask you a question. How come you keep calling them undocumented immigrants, huh? And I was like, wait a second. Usually people aren't throwing questions at me. I'm the one throwing questions at them. What's happening? What? And then I was a little bit thrown off my game, and I just said, well, just answer. And so I said, Sheriff Joe, I said, do you know who Elie Wiesel is? And he was like, huh? And I said, Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Peace Prize winner. I said, survivor of the Holocaust. I said, well, actually, the reason why I use the term undocumented immigrant is because he was the one who told me that there is no such thing as an illegal human being. And once you label them illegal, illegal immigrants, illegal aliens, you have made them into an illegal people. They are the other. They are less than. And that's exactly how the Holocaust started. They began by calling the Jews illegal people. And so those are terms that are being used in our midst and that you probably use without even thinking. And I'm here to ask you to think about that. The next time you hear that, the next time it comes out of your mouth or the mouth of someone that you know, just say, maybe not. Maybe not that term. I bet many of you have heard another term that might be considered offensive at one point. It was called WAP. How many of you know that term? You're a WAP. Yeah, you know what it stands for, right? Without papers. That's what a WAP is. I know, you all just thought it was something that you said to Italians. It was without papers. So this term has existed long before us. So, you know, what do the American people want? What do they want? If this is it, well, then here we are, okay? We're people in immigrant detention facilities that are not supposed to be jails, but everything about them says that they're jails. And they're not criminal detainees, they are civil detainees. And where these people actually have less standards, fewer standards, they get worse treatment than the most hardened criminals at the Bureau of Prisons in our country. Please hear me when I'm telling you. The people in these detention facilities, the standards are not there. So if you're in a Bureau of Prison, you'd rather be there. like the man who I met who was being deported from Miami back to the Dominican Republic and who had spent time in a Bureau of Prison in Pennsylvania. And he was like, BOP, I'm there. This stuff is crazy. What's happening now? So the problem is that, you see, usually we think that in our country, if you have some kind of treatment, there is recourse. There is legal recourse if you're abused. Usually in our country, there is legal recourse. We have rights. Guess what? There are no legal rights, no binding legal rights or standards for those who are detained in immigrant detention facilities in our country. None. None of the standards, wherever they may be, are legally binding at all. Wow. Think about that. Think about that. And you have a ready population. And you have basically a president and an administration that is very happy, proud of the numbers, the fact that deportations now are higher than they've ever been. And that detentions are just going up and up and up and up and up. And that they have quotas to meet. Now, is that who we are? You know, that maybe you just don't get daylight and you just don't get a phone call. Maybe that's where we are. I'm here to tell you that's where we are. So what does our president say? I don't think he's much of a leader on this. Nope, they are proud of the numbers. Enforcement proves to be a winner. Because that's what they say that Americans want. Enforcement, looking tough, doing something, cracking down on the problem. Because as long as there are undocumented people in our midst, there is a problem. And so they must be rounded up. And enforcement proves to be a winner. People like those numbers. I guess that's why the Obama administration is so intent on showcasing those numbers. Happily so. Wonderfully so. You'll see. So at what cost? Well, certainly the detention in and of itself comes at a cost of about $2 billion. Just the detention, okay? Detention. $2 billion a year. Now, the undocumented immigrants in our midst, in your midst, who are living in fear, they understand this. They understand that they are living in this country without papers. But the people who don't quite get it at all are the people, friends of yous, of yours, who you know. Yous, I was starting to get my Brooklyn thing going. Friends of yous, guys. You know, people who you know who live in this country with green cards. Right? And your friends with green cards, those of you who are in the audience with green cards, think you are safe. News for you, you're not safe. No. Not safe. Detention facilities filled with people with green cards who have been here 20 or 30 years. Not safe. No joke. Mandatory detention. Mandatory. Okay? Now, Mark Krikorian from Washington, D.C., who is anti-immigrant, says, you know what? Look, immigration was something that was happening when our country was young. It was our adolescent period. We're more sophisticated and advanced now. We're done with that kind of thing. Okay. He says, over and done with. Done. So, okay, fine, Mark Krikorian. I'd like us to have a national conversation about this so that we can think about the Statue of Liberty, what it says, who we are as a country. But you can't just decide that your think tank says, okay, we're done with that adolescent period in America of being so open to all those people. It's done. Well, no. I actually believe that Americans care. I believe that many of them just don't know. And they don't know because the media doesn't tell. And the media doesn't tell because immigration is a toxic issue. Unless, of course, you're Lou Dobbs, although it did turn out to be a toxic issue for him at CNN, cost them $8 million, and the credibility of their network and having to like reach over, bend over backwards to see if they can get a Latino audience that I hope doesn't deliver for them. Because what was it about for Lou Dobbs? What was it about? Money. It wasn't about making money for CNN. It was about making more money. CNN makes money. They wanted more money. They wanted to get into the ratings battle with Fox. And so that's why Lou Dobbs was there doing his shtick. Doing his shtick, yeah, Lou Dobbs. Now, for me to talk about immigration, frankly, it's a toxic issue. Again, I use that word because, you know, the assumption is that I have an agenda, that because I was born in Mexico, and because I've always been open about the fact that I kind of can't hide the María Hinojosa thing, although, boy, have people called me and just be like, can you change your name already? Like, can you Americanize it? And I'm just like, how do you want me to? You know, is it Hinojosa? What is it? Doesn't kind of roll off my tongue, but eh. So people think that I have an agenda. But here's the coolest thing about it is that, yeah, I have an agenda because I'm an American citizen. Because I actually made a choice to become an American citizen. And so I had to think long and hard about that. I had to rescind my Mexican citizenship. And I had to think long and hard about that. And I did. And I did. I took the little test. I went in, took my vows, the whole thing. Did it. I did it. So it means something to me, you know? It really does. Like when I talk about democracy with my kids, they understand that it's not just about going to the polling booth. It's also about seeing what democracy looks like on the street. And unfortunately, as a journalist, I do not go to demonstrations unless I'm covering them. So that's the hard part about being a mom. Because I feel like part of what democracy looks like, not part, an essential part of what democracy looks like is also that, is congregating in groups, in public, outside, being seen, a community, voicing, not just social media. What happened in Egypt, it wasn't because people were just like typing. They were out on the street. That's what democracy looks like, okay? So I take this very seriously, and I believe that what I do and the fact that my family suffers about the fact that they never see their mom and the wife, that I should be there, is because I'm doing this as a civic duty for you. For you, and I do it con todo corazón. Believe me, I would so love to be retired about now. I swear, I'm tired. But I do this because I know that there are young journalists who are saying, she's doing it. And so I don't give up. I swear. I really would love to just like be looking at the ocean. And seriously, I could use that. But we need to see this in this moment. We need to. And for some reason, I am lucky enough to be able to get there inside. And in that sense, thank you to the Obama administration that they did open up, that the Department of Homeland Security opened up and let us in. At least that is true. We are there. And they sat down with us. So thank you. Because that is an essential part, the transparency, letting us see. So, yeah, I became an American. And so I was given this award. I know you guys are going to be like, what? She was given the Outstanding American by Choice, the ABC Award. The Outstanding American by Choice Award. And guess who gave me the award and guess where? Well, it was given on Ellis Island at a citizenship swearing-in for about this many people. On Ellis Island, how cool. And guess who gave me the award? Gave me the award! Secretary Janet Napolitano. And she listened as I told my new citizens that what I learned as a Mexicana in this country, watching the media, watching 60 Minutes, and I hope they hire me one day too, is that part of the essential role of a democracy is also to have not only an engaged public, but to have a free media, a press that can question and critique, and that is an essential part of what we do. And Janet Napolitano listened and smiled throughout my entire speech. I swear, I am not lying. Okay, it is true. So, I just don't understand how much more we can take of this. Because in the wake of this inertia of policy decisions, in this wake of a lack of leadership, in this wake of laws that are coming, that are ripping our country apart, there are human lives in this wake. There are human laws. Lives, I mean. Human lives. And I know that the Obama administration says one thing, that they're not for family separation, but the reality is that there is no protocol. There is no protocol for any of these people who are going and detaining immigrants, going into their homes at 6 in the morning and taking them out here and there. And maybe you don't even know it's happening in your community because it happens at 6 in the morning. And there's so much shame involved. There is so much shame. But never at that moment is there any protocol about asking this person who is now detained, do you have American-born children? Because that might matter. That might matter because then that person who's going to be put in a detention center that is basically a tent, okay, where you're not supposed to be held for more than a couple of weeks, suddenly you're held there for 2 years because you're going to fight your case because you have American citizen children. And that is costing you and me $122 per day, per head. Okay? Because that's the way they talk about it. Per head. The government is paying to the private detention facility. And how much is he actually spending on that detainee? Well, I talked about the food with maggots because it saves money. So you get the picture. But we're paying $122 per head to now detain the largest group of detainees ever. How do you feel about that? Not me. How do you feel about that? What are you going to do about that? How much are you going to talk about that? It's not about me. It's about you. I will need your help. Yes, let me tell you, I will need your help because they will come after me. Definitely. So please become my friends on Facebook, please, or something like that, or Twitter, or whatever you choose, because then you'll know when the documentary is coming out, and you can watch it. Yeah, it's not going to be pretty. But the thought that I want to leave you with is this. What does it mean that right now, in our country, someone can be denied basic due process? A human being can be denied due process in our country. What does it mean if that can happen within our borders? I guess I'll just leave you with the thought that by a strange moment of fate that I would end up reporting this story and at the same time being asked to go to the Dominican Republic to report this other story about, within this island, Dominicans on this side of the island deporting Haitians to this side of the island. There's a long history of hatred and distrust between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, even though they're on the same geographic space. It's long and it's ugly. It involves takeovers and massacres. But the fact is that right now, that's happening. And I don't know. You know, if the United States is supposed to be the model of a free democracy, then why shouldn't the Dominican Republic be doing that and be denying citizenship to children of undocumented immigrants that are born there and rounding up people at 6 in the morning? And they don't have camps, but they do just drive you and deport you. Well, why not? Why not call them illegal anyway? Because the world's greatest democracy does. Why can't we? It's a wonderful thing to be a role model for the rest of the world, isn't it? Right? So I hope that you will listen to that report on Latino USA this week, and I think it's going to be on Need to Know on Friday night. Need to Know that replaced our beloved Now on PBS. Oh, our beloved Now on PBS. How much we love it and miss it. But so be it. It changed our lives. I'm going to leave you with one upbeat story, and then we can sit down and talk. I love this story. It's not quite, well, it sort of follows through, but I love this story. And it'll make you smile, and that'll make you feel good. So during September 11th, I was working at CNN in New York, and it was definitely the story that I never thought I would ever have to cover. And it was really, really shocking. Yeah, definitely not pretty. But within 2 days, a day actually after September 11th, I knew that there were undocumented immigrants. And again, many of you know that I tried to give voice to the voiceless, to the most invisible. And, you know, as my husband says, you find the saddest country, the poorest country, and inside the poorest country and the saddest country, you find the poorest and saddest people and talk to them. And I'm like, you're right, it's true. And he's like, I just want you to be happy. And I'm like, I'm trying, honey. But after September 11th, you know, I knew that there were undocumented immigrants. And so we went out and we did a story of undocumented, a man, Antonio Melendez, who worked at Windows on the World. And we went to find his family, Julia Hernandez and her four children, three of which were U.S. citizens and one of which was undocumented, like Julia. And we put this story on the air on CNN, and really the response was quite wonderful to have people from Kansas and Oklahoma and, you know, Oregon sending her little cards of, you know, thank you and good wishes. And in December of 2001, a couple of months after 9/11, I get a phone call, and on the other end of the line is somebody who answers like this, hi! Is this Maria Hinojosa? And I was like, Hinojosa, yeah. Hi, Ms. Hinojosa. Listen, my name is A.J. Dinkins, and I'm originally from Augusta, Maine. No, I'm originally from South Carolina, but I live in Augusta, Maine now, and I have a beauty salon. And my partner Rudy and I in our church, we just raised several thousand dollars for Julia Hernandez and the Hernandez children. And so I'd like to come down to New York, Ms. Hinojosa, and deliver these gifts to the Hernandez family. But I've never been to New York, and I've never been to the Bronx where she lives. Would you please, Miss Hinojosa, come and get me from the airport on Sunday? And I said, AJ, listen, I'm going to come and get you from the airport on Sunday, but I'm coming with a camera crew because I'm going to do the story of the day that the gay hairdresser from Maine came to deliver gifts of love to the September 11th undocumented Mexican immigrant family from the Bronx. So, no, it's a true story. True story. Actual true story. So AJ came down on Sunday, and, you know, he's a hairdresser, so he had dyed his hair red, because, of course, that's what he does. It was Christmas time, so Santa Claus. And we take him up to the Bronx, and AJ had, this is 2001, Augusta, Maine, so the Mexicans had not arrived in New York, in Maine yet. They're there now, but back then they weren't. So, you know, AJ had never met any Mexicanos, period. And Julia had never met a white gay man that she didn't work for. So it was an interesting union there. And I didn't know what to expect, but you know what? It was a love fest. It was just a total love fest. And everybody just got together and just loved each other. And AJ gave gifts to all the kids. And they didn't understand each other because AJ doesn't speak Spanish and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And as AJ was leaving, he was like, oh, I love this family so much. I want to invite them to my farm in Augusta, Maine. And I just thought, we'll see if that ever happens. Well, you know, fast forward 6 months. It's July of 2002. And the 1 year anniversary of September 11th is around the corner. And phone rings and it's like, AJ, hey, Maria, listen, I want you to pack up your husband and kids and come on up to my house, because I've just invited Julia Hernandez, her four kids, plus a cousin to come and spend a week at my farm, and I want you to join me. And I said, AJ, I will be there, and I'm not bringing my husband or my kids, but I'm bringing a camera crew. Because I'm going to be there to tell the story of the gay hairdresser and his partner, Rudy the farmer, who invited the undocumented immigrant family to their home in Maine for a week. And so we went up to Maine. Now, I had never been to Maine in the summertime. And boy, the bushes really know what they're talking about. That Maine is like, woof, it's beautiful in the summertime. My God. But at that time, it was a little homogeneous. And so I don't know if you can imagine that. There's Rudy with blonde hair, AJ with blonde hair, Rudy, 6 feet tall, wearing overalls because he's a farmer. Julia, her four kids, plus the cousin, myself, my cameraman, a hippie with the ponytail, and my African-American sound tech. And, you know, we were just in downtown Augusta, Maine, like having the time of our lives, and everybody's like, who are these people? What are they doing together? And why do they look so happy? What is going on here? We don't understand this. And, of course, all of us were there to make the children happy, because we wanted them to not have to be thinking about the 1 year anniversary of their dad dying on September 11th. And the fact that their mom was still undocumented, and so was their brother, and so therefore their lives were completely unsure, even though they had a father who died an American hero. And so we did a wonderful story, and it was really moving. And as I was leaving, I asked AJ, you know, what made him do this? And he said, you know what, it was special for me to invite them, But it was really truly special for Julia to say thank you and accept the invitation and put herself outside of her comfort zone. And that's, in a way, what I'm asking all of you to do at every moment in your lives, is to think about being the other, is to think about living your life like the other in our United States day after day. Because Julia did that. She took her kids to the family of a gay couple that she didn't know. And AJ opened his house to a bunch of Mexicans that he barely knew, who then, by now, really were American kids. And they all got along famously. And my image of who we are as the United States of America is a photograph of me, AJ, and Julia. AJ with, in the middle, with his American flag t-shirt, and on either side, me and Julia in Maine. And that's my America. Thank you so much.
Concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
So we're going to just talk for a while, partly about the conversation, that the talk that you just gave, and some other things too. And I want to start with something that, well, I had a while back Mayor Koss on my show. By the way, those of you who don't know, I'm the host of the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, which airs on Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 in the morning. And Mayor Koss was on my show one time, and we were talking about an immigration raid that had happened in Santa Fe, and he gave a really impassioned statement about how the Constitution applies to everybody in the United States. What you just talked about is obviously, if that is true, unconstitutional. Have there been or are there constitutional legal challenges to the 1996 immigration bill that gave rise to all of this?
No. No. Well, but I'm not going to get this right because it's not my level. But yes, it did come to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld. I'm trying to remember exactly what part they upheld. But it is one part of it. So it has been challenged. What hasn't happened yet is for there to be a case before the International Human Rights Court, which could happen.
Do you have any examples? I mean, you talked about how people who have green cards are so vulnerable. What are some examples of people who have been...
Okay, so I know, because it's just like, what is she talking about? All right, so let me see. Basically what happened in 1996 is that certain crimes became subject to mandatory detention. And it's called exactly like this, mandatory detention. There was the creation of a term called aggravated felon, which sounds like it's a really bad, somebody who's not just a felon, but an aggravated felon. And under these categories, there are crimes that if committed, and you get a sentence of a year and a day, then you are subject to mandatory detention. And you are considered an aggravated felon in immigration laws. So what would happen is that, for example, if you had a green card and in 1990 you were caught once selling or with drugs, marijuana or cocaine, and you got a suspended sentence. But it was a sentence of a year and a day, and you never served any time, and you just completed parole, even in that situation. Or if you were, in fact, convicted and found guilty, and you went to prison and completed your sentence, and that was in 1990, when you were a legal permanent resident, and now, one day, there's a knock at your door, and they'll just say, hello, we're looking for... Well, there's a whole other part of that, which is how they appear at your homes, but... They would come and they could take you from your home with a green card. Or you could have some kind of interaction with the police. For example, you have a broken taillight on your car and you're stopped. And at that point, then they can put you back into the system. And they may take you into the local jail to talk about the broken taillight or the tickets that you didn't pay, and you'll think that that's resolved, and you'll walk out, and immigration will be waiting for you right outside the door, and they'll pick you up. So even if you have been in this country and served a sentence and have been without any criminal conviction since then, so 20 years without any problems, you are now, in essence, it's double jeopardy. Now, people who I've come into contact with who are legal permanent residents now who have a green card, and they just say, no, 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 but I'm going to be okay. And I just paint this scenario for them. You're at a party, and you get an offer to get a ride home. And you get in the car, and everybody's having a great time, and all of a sudden you're in the car being driven home, and the car is stopped for some reason. And the person who's driving maybe had one drink, and so then the police say, you know what, we really want to search your car. They search, and in the glove compartment they find four joints. Well, now, as you know, in a situation like that, everyone in the car is charged with possession. And so now you're a legal permanent resident who's in a car where there's possession. And that's it. That's it. You could be mandatorily detained. So that's what it looks like.
One of the, I think, the strains of political culture in our country is a kind of hostility to trying to understand, and as you put it in your talk, humanize people who you feel are threatening. And you encountered this when you talked to gang members and reported on them, and there were some people who said, well, they're so bad, they don't deserve airtime. When you humanize people, you do begin to understand. The same thing happens with immigrants. The same thing happens with prisoners. How can you break through, how can you penetrate that resistance that so many people in this country have?
I think that you just stay on it. I think that it really is a matter of just not giving up. I think it is constantly engaging. And it's constantly engaging with people who are different than you. I know that people always find it interesting that I'm able to sit down and and have conversations with people who they would consider to be very, I don't know, fill in the blank. Just, I can't believe you're able to sit down and talk to someone like that. And it's just like, no, I do that because I try to humanize them. And so then that's my job. That's not what you do necessarily, but that's what I do. And so I feel like it is giving them a sense of humanity.
Did anything good, do you think, come out of your interview with the sheriff?
I got a chance to meet him, which was really interesting. I think a lot of people have watched the interview and enjoyed it. I wish you could have seen the whole thing. It was pretty intense. And I think that he found somebody who was not prepared to kind of back down. I think that he thought that he could, kind of bully me, and that didn't quite work out for him. I think one of the things that I talk about this interview, that is not kind of in the public, is that after, Sheriff Joe Arpaio is very proud of the fact that he spent time in Latin America and that he speaks Spanish. He lived in Mexico. He's very proud of this. And so after the interview, he said, he was speaking to me in Spanish, muy a la mexicana, con una buena onda, así como que no, yo sé todo del DF porque yo viví allí, soy de allí. And he was just like doing this whole kind of Mexico City thing, and like, I'm so cool because I live there, and I blah, 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 blah. And so I was like, okay. And I was like, pues, oígame, sheriff, déjame hacerte una pregunta. I'll translate in a second. Le dije, oiga, ¿de verdad, sheriff, que tú crees que todos esos paisanos están viniendo para destruir este país? ¿Tú crees, sheriff, de verdad? I was like, basically like, so Mr. Sheriff, do you, you're so hip and you get the Mexican thing. So do you really think that these Mexicans are coming to destroy the United States of America and like purposefully take over and take everyone's jobs? Like, really? And he was like, no lo creo. And that just, because for whatever people's agendas, in this case, I do believe they have one, again, there is just a human wake of suffering that comes. And that is of great concern to me as a human being.
I was reading your book, Cruz, Gang Members Talk to Maria Hinojosa, and reading it, I mean, it was just a story of one heartbreak after another. I mean, the way these young men were treated as children, and then they do these things they do, which are, you know, sometimes awful. And it really looked to me like the reasons that they do some of those things are the same reasons a lot of people in Washington, D.C. do the things that they do, which is that they want the feeling of power. They like it. And how can this quest for power that results in gang violence be transformed into something positive? And I know I can ask that about Washington, D.C. too, but let's stay with gangsters.
Well, look, and I actually just revisited all the guys from that particular crew, the main crew. I just was with them because they had a 20th reunion, and so it's a radio piece that's in the making. You know, for them, and if you're talking about kids and gangs, it is really about wanting to feel like you have some kind of control and some power. And so, you know, I feel like with young people, it's oftentimes, I mean, look, once they get into a gang, it's much harder. But before they get into a gang, engaging with them and talking with them and giving them respect as it is so important and can break through so many barriers. And again, it's like the simplest thing. And it's, you know, how do you do that? I would, again, encourage you to just have conversations with people who you don't think you necessarily could. And just engage with them. Engage. Talk to them. As opposed to seeing, you know, some kind of, like, barrier of, you know, gang member or whatever, hoodlum, et cetera, et cetera. That often makes them feel powerful, actually being recognized. Because they feel like you are seeing them, you are giving them respect, and that makes them feel powerful.
Yeah, it was so interesting in that book. They liked you because you weren't scared of them.
Exactly, exactly, and that's really cool for them. And so again, a message for all of you, which is that they get off on the fact that you might be fearful of them, but what really trips them up is when you're suddenly really engaging with them. It takes me back, let me just indulge for 1 second, about a story that popped into my mind today for some reason, because I was thinking about humanity. And I know that, you know, people might be like, oh, you know, that there's not enough oomph there in that conversation about people touching one another on a very human level. But I was thinking about the story of the Cantor and the Klansman from Nebraska, from Lincoln, Nebraska, where there was this KKK, the head of the KKK, who used to call and harass people. You know, what people didn't realize was that he was actually dying. He was diabetic and he was dying, and he was in a wheelchair in his home. And so that he wasn't really very, he was kind of like the Wizard of Oz. He would just call people, but really he was powerless. And when the new Jewish cantor came to town, he would call him and just be like, I'm going to kill you. I hate you. I'm with the KKK. And the cantor was very worried, you know, because everybody knew that this guy had, like, guns in his house, but no one had really seen him. And the cantor did some research and found out that he was in a wheelchair, that he didn't have a lot of people around him. And so one time when the KKK guy called, the cantor said, you know, I'm sure you're a little lonely and hungry tonight. Have you been able to do your food shopping? How about if I go pick up some groceries for you? And the KKK guy was like, what? Shut up! Ah! And every day when the KKK guy would call the cantor, he'd say, and how are you? What can I get for you today? And he killed him with kindness, to the point that he then invited him, the KKK guy invited the cantor to his house. They met. He went alone. I know it sounds incredible, but the KKK guy actually then was taken in by the cantor and his family as he was dying, and he converted to Judaism, and he died in their home. I swear, it was on NPR, I met them, I swear. It's a true story.
If that reminds me, I'm just going to put it out there, about, it reminds me of a documentary called An Unlikely Friendship, which was about a friendship in 1971 between a KKK member and a black activist in Durham, North Carolina. And they were put together to try to solve an education problem, and they became best friends, and both of their friends rejected them, but they were friends for life. Okay, so I put out on my Facebook a call for questions because we were doing the index card thing tonight, and I got some responses, and one of them was from a 21-year-old Mexican immigrant who grew up here in Santa Fe, and she was telling me that she's in college, but virtually all of her immigrant friends from high school are not choosing education, and in fact, they already have children, and they're not listening to Latino USA, they're not tuning into the bigger picture. How to reach that generation?
Well, I think that that's a huge problem. I think that, you know, and what continues to surprise me is the fact that on a national level, it's not understood that, you know, a Latino dropout rate of 50% is not a Latino problem. It is our problem. That a Latina teen pregnancy issue is not that community's issue. It's all of ours issues. And I wonder how many of her young friends actually are here without papers. And so, in fact, give up. Because what future do they have? They're just like, what am I supposed to do? I mean, I don't have anything here. And nothing is telling me that I can't have anything here. But I can have a child. I can create a family. So, you know, I think it's about... I think it's, again, I get back to, you know, engaging them, talking with them. Certainly if there are, and I don't know enough about Santa Fe. I know that, for example, the mayor of San Antonio has really taken this on. He's a really interesting guy, Julian Castro, being eyed as a real possible contender in Democratic politics on a national level. Him and his brother, twin brothers, from Harvard and Stanford. And he's taken on the issue of Latina teen pregnancy as a citywide problem. So there's like kind of a structure of looking at this. So apart from perhaps, you know, on your local level, just actually talking to your mayor or local, I mean, I know you've got great activists groups around here who are very active. Somos un pueblo unido, to name a few. God, I love you guys. Where are you? You guys are so cool. We love you. That's what democracy looks like, and that's really what our future looks like. That's what our future looks like. And that kind of leadership, and if we're smart in our country, all of you are encouraging young leaders like them to believe in themselves, to own their voices, to know that they have a role in American democracy, and all of you are seeing in them our leaders for the future, not their leadership for their community and their group, but our leaders, and that we are inspiring the men and the women of Somos Un Pueblo Unido to remain and to inspire other pueblos across the United States, because we know that in the end, that will prevail. That will prevail. I completely believe, even though I always see the glass half empty, I completely believe that in the end, we will come to another place. Look, this is a country that elected President Barack Obama. We never thought that that was going to happen, okay? And it did. So whether or not he has understood his opportunity or his missed opportunity, I think we all need to understand that what happens represents all of us. Forget about him necessarily. It represents all of us. And so encouraging young leaders like Somos Un Pueblo is what all of us should be doing.
Talk more about the leaders you see. I mean, you talk about Julian Castro. There's also, I mean, there are very interesting Latino leaders in this country. There's also this growing group of Republican Latinos, like the governor of this state.
Well, I think, you know, I think that there's been a lot of conversation among the Latino community about, you know, leadership. And I think that that is a really important conversation to have. And I think, again, while we may, I mean, we do happen to have an extraordinary role model now, all of us, not just Latinos, all of us, in Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who is, wow. She really is something else. I heard her talk recently. And actually, If all goes well, there is an HBO documentary that will be coming out in September called No Latinos, K-N-O-W, Latinos. And she, it was the first on-camera interview that she gave that I did with her. And hopefully that's going to end up on HBO in September. But I was with the Supreme Court Justice recently, and she was talking specifically to young women in this particular audience for celebrating International Women's History Month. And she said, somebody asked her about her guidance for young people, and she said, you know, I lived with fear my whole life. My whole life I've lived with fear, because she was the other growing up in the projects of the South Bronx. She said, and there was so much fear that sometimes I would get into a state of panic over my fear, or feel like I was just going to collapse, or I would, you know, I would turn down jobs because I was afraid. The fear would consume me. And she said to these young people, do not let that fear control you. Do not let that fear control you. So I think in terms of leadership, she is so human in that sense, and so really pushes through. And I think on a local level, I mean, on a national level, I'm hesitant to start pointing fingers, because I think that there's leadership, you know, whether it's National Council of La Raza or the Willy Velasquez Institute, or, you know, Southwest Voter, or in Chicago, or in New York, or the Dream Activists. I mean, there are so many leaders. I think I'm much more interested in encouraging them to completely own their power and their voice. And I think at this moment in our country, as I've said before, it's really hard to be a Latino, because you don't know. It's like, I call it the U.S. Mambo. You know, some days it's like, woohoo, everything is great. Oh my God, it's amazing. Look at these numbers. And Univision is beating, you know, in the ratings. And oh my God, everybody's eating tacos and it's like fabulous. And then it's like, you know, ugly Betty, woo, you know. And then all of a sudden you're just like, oh my God, you know, the hate crimes and the assaults and the detention and, you know, and the speak English and all this kind of stuff. So U.S. Mambo, three steps forward, two steps back.
And what about the Republican piece?
The Republican piece, I think, is really interesting. I want to be in those back rooms hearing the conversations that are going on with Republicans right now and Latinos. And I think that there are people within the Republican Party who understand. The last elections just showed it. The growth among Latino Republicans is there. And I think, again, it's because the Democrats have kind of once again let the ball drop. You know, they haven't realized, they haven't taken this moment and owned it truly, and created, you know, a solid base. And so Republicans are stepping into the fray. That's what politics looks like. I know that it can't be easy for a woman of color to be in the political game. So kudos to her for doing that. And I think it looks like democracy when you challenge her. So, and she's got to be up to doing that. And so that's what it looks like. You guys challenge and she moves forward and you keep your eyes on her in terms of the local. And in terms of national, I think it's a fascinating time in Republican politics. I think, you know, Utah is really fascinating. We interviewed the Republican Attorney General last week for Latino USA, did a really interesting interview because, as you know, Utah is trying to become the anti-Arizona. So it's very, very interesting. Just a little sidebar. The Attorney General is a member of the Church of the Latter-day Saints, Mormons, and Mormons happen to be the fastest-growing group of converts to the church are Latinos. And so there's an interesting politic going on just in terms of Utah.
This is a question that came in from a radio producer who asked, is NPR able to maintain genuine editorial freedom given the relationship between the U.S. Congress and corporate America?
Well, you know what? See, the thing is that, you know, when you work in a place like NPR, you know, you're doing your job. And there are people who are smart journalists who are there, who are working, who are encouraging, you know, independent thinking, and who are prepared to push the envelope in terms of what NPR, at least in its heyday, you know, really was. I think that NPR, as it has become more mainstream, has lost some of that edge, which is too bad. But I don't know if it's like, you know, this big plan and, you know, whether or not there's, you know, this attempt to control. The problem is that when, you know, journalists are human beings too. And so they react to things like, not again with this kind of political mask all the time of, you know, if I put this on the air, what's going to happen? You know, some people are thinking that. But unfortunately, I would rather them to just be thinking about doing good, solid journalism. And encouraging that. And frankly, at this moment in history, in our United States of America, doing that kind of hardcore, serious journalism is harder and harder in the mainstream. And so we're in a time of tremendous flux and change, and I don't have the answers. And, you know, I'm not sure what it's going to look like. We're creating it, and you're creating it as we speak. And I would just hope that, you know, the people within NPR right now, which is going through such a difficult time, as journalists, remember what our mission is. As I said in PBS, what is our mission? What is our mission? We represent the public, and that means a cross-section. And we must understand, you must understand that there is no agenda. There really isn't. There isn't an agenda that comes down like this, but these are journalists, and so they have the same, you know, they have the same, I don't want to say corporate influence, but, you know, they will react to stories in the same way as many as you or as people unlike you. It's, you know, it's hard.
I mean, at our station, KSFR, the reason we carry the BBC right now is because during the run-up to the Iraq War, they were just, NPR was just pure cheerleaders.
Yeah, that was really hard. That was really hard. I was at CNN at the time, and actually, some of you might remember that I went in to my bosses, and I was like, you know what, we can't have a situation where people are protesting against this war and about, against the run-up, and that we're not covering it. How can that be? Again, this is what democracy looks like. I'm just such a believer in kind of street democracy. And so I became the de facto protest correspondent, whether it was pro or against the war. That's what I did, and I was really proud of it, even though I did kind of feel like I was being set up, which happens, you know, to a journalist who people perceive to have an agenda. And so, yeah, it was hard. It was a very difficult time, and being a journalist who questioned, it was really hard. But I'm telling you right now, every journalist in the mainstream, most of them are looking over their shoulders and waiting for the axe to drop. And that is not a good way to have journalists living in our country. Not a good way.
When you say the axe to drop, so somebody does a story that their sponsors, their advertisers don't like?
People are getting laid off left and right. People are getting laid off left and right. That's the reality. And people can be laid off left and right because everybody knows that. And so what is going to make you go in and have that big fight with your editor over this story about an immigrant who was detained, who blah, 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 and the editor? You're not going to do that. Why are you going to go and put your... Because, you know, when the list comes down that you've got to tighten up the belt, you know what? That guy came in here. I really didn't like the fact that he came in. He was arguing for that story. Yeah. It's not good. What you want in your newsrooms is people to be going to and be engaging. That's why you argue for a diversity in the media. It's not just, oh, so you can say you have diversity. It's because you want people engaging in that kind of intellectual back and forth. And you're not going to have that in an atmosphere where everybody thinks they're about to be laid off.
You said during your talk that when the Frontline documentary comes out, you expect a backlash. How can public opinion, how can this audience and your other audiences back you up?
I think it's really about backing up the journalism. So watch. Watch and tell others to watch and just don't be silent. Let your opinion be heard. That's all I can ask for. Because as I said, this is not, this is fact-based journalism. That's what we do at Frontline. That's what we did at Now on PBS. And that's why it's so sad that it went away. It's fact-based journalism. There really isn't an agenda here except to tell you what happened and what exists now. And so what we do know is that people are very much in tune with these kinds of things, this kind of coverage, and certainly when it's dealing with public media, they're very in tune. So they will engage. And I just want you to engage from your own perspective.
This question came from a teacher who asks, given the inadequacy of media coverage on immigration issues, what would you recommend for a Santa Fe high school teacher who wants to foster the growth of knowledgeable, informed citizens?
In general or specifically on immigration?
Specifically on immigration.
Well, listen to Latino USA. get the podcast. It's interesting because there aren't really a lot. I would pull the articles that Nina Bernstein wrote for the New York Times that deal with the issue of immigrants in detention. I don't have at my fingertips all of the organizations that I follow, whether it's on Twitter or on Facebook, but there are a lot of them. And certainly the DREAM activists are young people, and they are young people who have a story to tell, and I would think that that's a good way in which you want high schoolers to engage with other high schoolers. And I would actually say be creative. I think when you're teaching high school kids, the sky's the limit. So don't think about something that may have been done already, but think about creating your own. And I don't know what that looks like, whether it's, you know, letters in exchange with other DREAM activists or, going and looking at a place where there's activism taking place on this particular issue. I know that there was a big, when I was in Albuquerque, a young group of journalists from KUNM went out to, the World Social Forum.
Social Forum.
So getting young people involved in that sense, don't feel like you have to do something that's already been done. I would encourage you to be really experimental and actually ask the kids to direct you, maybe.
This came from another Latina, and she asked, given the tremendous diversity of Latin cultures from Puerto Rico, Argentina, the Andes, Mexico, she said, what unites us as Latinos?
Well, the language. And as Latinos, what unites us is that we're living here, because there are no Latinos living in Argentina. There are Argentinians and Latin Americans living in Argentina. There are no Latinos living in, unless, you know, maybe I went down there, but even then. So what we share is that we're Latinos in the United States of America. And I think what we share is this dynamic of, you know, being, you know, part of this U.S. mambo, right, where we're moving forward and yet being pulled back. I worry often that perhaps, and I get this criticism, that I talk about immigration too much, that in terms of Latino issues, immigration is one of many. But we are living in this country, and so we're dealing with the same issues, whether it's schools or education or jobs or, you know, workers' rights. We're all dealing with those issues. So, but I think that, as I said before, I said, you know, having your Republican governor, Martinez, is the tip of the iceberg. Latinos are not a monolithic group. And so I'm kind of surprised when I hear people not kind of see what's happening in front of them. You know, when we have to say Latinos are the only demographic group that is growing in the United States of America. And kind of pause with that. It is the only demographic group that is growing. And so we should all really want to know as much as we can about Latinos. You guys are lucky because you live in New Mexico. And because you have Somos Un Pueblo Unido. You can go talk with them.
last question. I've just been reading your book, Raising Raul, which is wonderful. And by the way, the two books that Maria Hinojosa has written are out of print right now, but they may come back into print. And so there's going to be in the lobby afterwards a list. So if you are interested in these books, which you should be, you can sign up and then get notice if and when they do come back into print. So reading this book, I have to ask you, do you feel like you've found a harmonious balance between work and the rest of your life? And do you have any advice for those who maybe are imbalanced toward work?
Híjole. So I'll just tell you that on Saturday afternoon when I... because I had just come back on Friday night after having been away for most of last week and the week before and the week before. And my daughter said, when I said,
I have to leave on Sunday. And she was like, Mom, when you finish shooting this Frontline documentary, I'm baking a cake, an ice cream cake. I said, you can't bake ice cream. She was like, oh, Mom. I have an amazing partner who believes in my work, who believes in what I do from a very profound place. He is an artist. He is the opposite of me. He creates and imagines beauty, and I go into the depths. And that conversation, that taking care of that relationship is a constant thing that I must do. And thankfully, he calls me on it when I'm in my world. So having a partner who really understands and with whom you can engage in this conversation about why we do what we do. I mean, I just became a syndicated columnist. That's my newest job, and I did that because I couldn't say no, because I'm a Mexican and I never say no to work. But because of the civic responsibility to do this now and to reach a wider audience. So he is incredibly understanding, and I have kids that I talk to all the time. And so when I'm with them, I try to be with them as much as possible, talk about things that are going on in their lives. And they're young American teens. 2 weeks ago, a young man, a senior from my son's New York City Public High School, one of the top 15 in the city, a senior baseball star, fell off of a roof and killed himself. I can't get into specifics, but it was very, very dramatic. And my son is dealing with this, and so we've spent a lot of time talking. You know, I make it a point to walk to school with them as far as I can, now walking my son to the subway, talking with them about what it's like, engaging with them, because I grew up in this country with parents who didn't talk with me, not because they didn't want to, but because they didn't know about what I was going through as an American teen. They have tremendous patience. I apologize a lot. You know, the first thing I did actually when I got into the car to get me to the airport to come here was I picked up the phone. I was like, I'm really sorry I wasn't nice to all of you. Because I always get all worked up when I've got to get out and get to the airport and all this. Even though I do it every day, it's like, why am I getting all worked up about it? So I apologize a lot. Recognize being humble. And I love the fact that they're old enough to know and be able to see for themselves when the product, you know, or when people stop me and say, thank you for your work. I have to say, I'm feeling definitely out of balance now. It's been, you know, shooting an hour documentary, along with doing everything else, launching my own company, writing the syndicated column, you know, getting Latino USA on the air, dealing with the staff, you know, blah, 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 trying to get projects funded by PBS, you know, trying to survive, all of it. It's been a very intense time. And sometimes I feel really out of balance, and I find myself crying a lot because what I've seen, my friends, is really, 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 really devastating. I didn't even tell you the half of it. So I gave myself a gift today in name of balance. It was actually one of those wonderful things. I actually had some time free that wasn't booked. And so I gave myself a massage today. Well, I went to get it. And it was amazing, I think, just being here, being with somebody who really understood when I said I'm hurt, not physically, but emotionally, that they really understood that. And being here and knowing I was going to see you and has just really helped me. So it's a constant. It's a constant. And there is no answer. And I think it's about understanding the power that and the responsibility that I have. That is the good thing about getting older. Is being able to say, okay, I do have some power, and using that for good, and just recognizing that there is my family, and it's not right for them to see me sad all the time. So as soon as I'm done with this doc, well, actually, in 2 weeks, no, I'm taking my kids to Mexico, and I'm taking them to Oaxaca, a very spiritual place. And I know that this will feed their souls. They will be with their grandparents. They will be in a place that will, you know, be like a junkie feeding them. Like, these are your roots. This is where you came from. This is part of who you are. And that is my gift to them. That and a new pair of tennis shoes and a Broadway show. And a new computer for my husband, and then I'm set. It's a daily thing. A daily process, and we're all in it together.
Maria Hinojosa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Become my friends on Facebook.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.